Support for Out in the Bay comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to technology, volunteering time, providing financial support, and connecting people in need to high-speed internet at home. More at california.comcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Today we meet Imani Rupert Gordon, the National Center for Lesbian Rights' new executive director. A longtime advocate for LGBTQ people of color, Rupert Gordon took the helms at this groundbreaking San Francisco-based LGBTQ legal organization in March, just as COVID-19 hit full force. Before coming to NCLR, Rupert Gordon held leadership roles at two Chicago nonprofits, the Broadway Youth Center and Affinity Community Services, the nation's oldest Black LGBTQ social justice organization. Her leadership in the queer community has been recognized nationally, and last year, the Illinois Human Rights Commission presented her with its 2019 Activism Award. But Rupert Gordon's fans say she is much more than her resume. In the Los Angeles Blade, her predecessor at NCLR, former executive director Kate Kendall, is quoted as saying, "Apart from her substantial resume, experience, and gravitas, the thing I most remember when I first met Imani in San Jose was a smile that had a wattage unlike most I'd ever seen and an open-heartedness that made me feel like we had been friends for years. You can't teach that kind of openness and generosity of spirit. It is something one either possesses or never gets. She had it, and that quality is one of those intangibles that marks a leader for the ages." And I'll just note that her Twitter profile says she likes sisters, cats, guitars, and equity. Imani Rupert Gordon joins us to discuss her life and her vision for NCLR. So Imani, welcome and congratulations on your new position.
Eric, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, let's just start with who you are. For listeners who aren't familiar with you and your story, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much. So I grew up in Southern California. I started out in the desert and then kind of moved to a beach when I went to college and really just liked being by a beach. And so I moved to Santa Cruz and worked at UC Santa Cruz for about 10 years. And then I moved out to Chicago to get my master's degree in social work. And my then girlfriend, now wife, we moved out there and we just fell in love with Chicago and just had a wonderful, wonderful time. When I was there, I worked at the Howard Brown Health Center, running the Broadway Youth Center, serving LGBTQ youth experiencing homelessness and housing instability, and worked there for a couple of years. And then I moved to Affinity Community Services, serving the entire LGBTQ community, looking specifically at Black LGBTQ plus women. And I was the executive director there for 4 years. And so when I think about the way that I want to do work, it's always looking at the most underrepresented within already underrepresented identities.
So what brought you to the NCLR? I understand there was some fairly aggressive pursuing of you. Kate Kendall had led the organization for 22 years, a longtime lawyer. You're a social worker. What was the decision-making process on whether you should come to this organization?
This is a question that I actually get a lot, and I completely understand why. This position at NCLR previously has only been held by lawyers. And when the recruiter reached out to me, they said that the team had been asking about me and wanted to know if I was interested. And I asked them, I said, do they remember that I'm not a lawyer? And they said, yeah, they remember. And it really made me think. I really sincerely believe that the way to get to equality is to work with the most underrepresented, and that is going to bring everyone with us. And so thinking about that, that's kind of the thread that runs through the positions I've had. I want to help our community get to equality. And, you know, my work with LGBTQ youth experiencing homelessness and housing instability, working at Affinity Community Services, serving Black LGBTQ plus women, and then working at NCLR. You know, NCLR was created to fill a hole so that the movement is more inclusive. And that's what they're looking for. And I know that I'm not a fit for all organizations. I told them when they hired me, I told them if they're not sincerely interested in grappling with intersections of identity, how to make our movement more racially and economically just, then they shouldn't hire me because I am not the best. I wouldn't be the best fit for that because intersectionality matters, and that's what's going to show up in my leadership. That is what they were looking for. A permanent ED is not someone that's going to be litigating cases. You don't actually need to be a lawyer. In fact, it helps that someone has experience in balancing budgets, cleaning up things on the back end, creating institutional structures to support a team. And that's what they saw in me, and that's what I bring to NCLR. I also represent a good sounding board for our team as well, so that we are delivering our message so that everyone can be included. That's what they were looking for. So I'm just thrilled to be on the team.
Great. We're happy to have you here in the Bay Area, that's for sure. So you're taking this also from a perspective that's outside of the legal profession, not only with your administrative executive leadership skills, let's say, but also you're looking at it from a more holistic social approach. Is that fair to say with your social work background?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's something that's really important. You know, when I think about the way that we do our work, we have to be inclusive, we have to be intersectional. And that is something that, is honestly part of my identity. It's how I got to do this work. It's how I got to understand it. And that's also something that we learn in social work, that we teach other folks. NCLR has some of the most brilliant lawyers in the movement. As executive director, I think that, you know, providing a vision for folks is what's actually needed. Finding ways to think about things so that we are including more of us. And I've had a wonderful time I've been here for almost 5 months now. And I really am just thrilled with the work that we're doing. It's been great to get up to speed. I think that there is a perspective that I can bring. And certainly there's a learning curve for me too. I've been learning a lot from our team. They're absolutely brilliant and amazing for our movement.
I want to talk about intersectionality in just a minute, but I know there's one thing that's on everybody's minds right now, and that's this threat to mail-in voting, which is going to be crucial in this election coming up. You have mentioned that voter suppression is an issue for LGBTQ people, as well as Black and brown people in this country and other people who have been excluded many times in the past from the electoral process. Nancy Pelosi has actually called the House back into session this coming weekend to look at this crisis at the U.S. Postal Service to make sure that they will be able somehow to process ballots. What can people do and what should we be thinking about as this election approaches?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think this is just an incredibly disheartening time. I think I can't imagine that we thought that anything could get as bad as it is here. You know, voter suppression in this country has been a constant. It's not something that new, but what's happening now really is completely unprecedented. When we think about the fact that our administration is really weakening our postal service less than 3 months before an election and during a global pandemic, I mean, this is something else. So folks have been reaching out and saying, what can we do? And honestly, over the weekend, you know, I've been thinking sort of the same thing. There's really no precedent for this. So we're all working that out now. And so I was really happy to see yesterday, as you said, that Speaker Pelosi called Congress back from August recess to figure something out. You know, we don't know what this is going to be, but I'm going to guess that it's creating a legislative package that's going to protect the Postal Service. But when we think about what we're needing folks to do, we need folks to sound the alarm. Like, people need to know this, but then also once whatever Congress comes up with, we also need to, you know, provide it something that is going to actually help get folks out, make it safe for folks to vote, make it so that people are able to vote. We need to put pressure on our lawmakers to pass it, assuming that it's something that's actually good. But it's also important to know that this is more than just for the election. People rely on the Postal Service to receive medication, checks from the government. This is going to impact everyone, especially the most underrepresented and the most marginalized in our community. But when thinking about knowing that something like this is happening, I think it's more important than ever that we get out and we are making sure that we're voting. You know, I think the push before has been to vote by mail. And I don't know that that's something that that's going to get us to where we need. In many different counties, folks will be able to take your vote by mail ballot and drop it into drop off slots, but we're not sure if that's going to be everywhere. And so really we're kind of waiting to see what happens here, but really to pay attention. And once we hear something, that we all need to be making sure that we push this out. This is something that is completely unprecedented.
And you've told me just before we started to record this interview that NCLR is, things are changing by the minute. You're looking at possible options, but the best thing for everybody to do is just stay informed as the best as they can and follow what guidance comes from the organizations that they are involved with, because It could be that there's a legislative package. There could be that there's, we'll find out as we go along, what are the best ways to actually get our voices heard in this election.
Yeah, that's exactly it, because we don't know what's going to happen yet. You know, we are following this very, very closely and figuring out what it is that NCLR can do. And we're not sure what that is just yet. Voting is one of our rights, and this should be a very easy and simple process. And the fact that it isn't is, I mean, this is absolutely, I mean, I can't even believe that we're dealing with this, but that's,
it does feel like this is what we hear about third world countries. We hear about dictators in other countries stealing elections. And I mean, I can't say as a journalist that's what is happening, but it certainly brings that fear up, doesn't it?
it brings up fear. And it also, I mean, honestly, voter suppression is something that has always happened in this country. But this blatant way that this is happening right now today. You know, I am a Black woman. I have a long history of my relatives and ancestors remembering like what it was like being able to vote, what people like the ways that Jim Crow worked for folks, and seeing something like this, that it is going to be so incredibly hard to vote. And for people in rural communities, this is just, I mean, this is something that is absolutely unbelievable.
Okay, so this is a segue to talk about intersectionality, because I think in one of the articles I read about, you talked about as a child or a young woman, I think as a grade school kid, but I'm not sure, please correct me if I'm wrong, that you learned about the Constitution and about how women got the right to vote and Black people got the right to vote. And these were at different times, but you're like, well, what about me? I'm a Black woman, or I'm going to be a Black woman. how does this apply to me? And I'm in these different categories. So is that a sort of simple way to get into the discussion of intersectionality?
You know, that's a great place to start, honestly, because for intersectionality, you know, it's a buzzword now, but it's a feeling that many of us have felt for a very long time. And even if we didn't have a word for it, we definitely had a feeling for it. And for me, it was that we were talking about two different parts of my identity that were experiencing oppression in different ways. And so when I was young and trying to understand exactly how this worked, I think it was really difficult to understand that it was separate from me being a Black person and being a woman, and I was experiencing discrimination differently there. But I think what it was doing is really, you know, foreshadowing to me that when folks look at the way that oppression happens, often it is looking at one form of oppression, and that doesn't get to those of us that experience oppression at multiple levels. And so when I said that the work that I do is working with underrepresented groups within already underrepresented groups, what I'm talking about is an intersectional approach. But when we talk about that, it's really important that we talk about what intersectionality is, because it's not a word that is just a catch-all to mean that the world is unfair. And we get that wrong a lot. Intersectionality, it's more than why. It's kind of the how we get there. And that's the distinction we often get wrong. So it's actually referring to a case where a Black woman was suing her employer for discrimination on the basis of race and gender. She lost her job because of her identities of a Black woman. But ultimately, the judge determined that because Black men or because white women couldn't sue on the basis of these two identities, that she was actually asking for an unfair advantage, which wasn't true. It was that these Black men and these white women didn't need to and wouldn't need to sue on the basis of these two identities. So the part that was unfair is that the system wasn't set up for people that experience multiple marginalized identities. And that's what we talk about when we're talking about intersectionality. It's not just that it's difficult when you're Black and you're queer or a person of color or part of the LGBTQ community or low-income person. It's not just that it's difficult. It's how it's difficult, and it's how it's difficult, and that is because our systems aren't set up to meet people at multiple levels. So if we just take, for instance, one thing, if we just look at the LGBTQ community, there are going to be people, trans people, women that experience gender discrimination. There are going to be people of color that experience race discrimination within that. And so if we're only looking at someone's LGBTQ identity, we're not also taking in consideration the racism they might experience or the ableism they might experience or the oppression they might experience based on economic instability. So if we consider all of these, then we can actually get to LGBTQ equality. Otherwise, the people that experience other types of oppression are always going to be left behind. And so that's the important part of intersectionality. And we don't always go that deep into it, but it's really important because that's how we're going to get to equality.
So how does that come into your work on a day-to-day basis? Does that inform what cases NCLR decides to take on, for example?
Yeah, you know, it's really important for us when we think about how we want to make the most impact. For NCLR, historically, this has been looking at the most underrepresented. And then also we try to sort of move away from the pack and make sure that we are doing something that might be a bit different. You know, we were actually the first organization to challenge the transmilitary ban. And the important part here is that the transmilitary ban, whenever anyone is experiencing discrimination based on gender, that's affecting trans people, it's affecting women, but it's also saying that there is some part of your identity that means that you can't hold this position. The military is the largest employer in the United States. And so this is actually really, really dangerous if we would have just let this go. Otherwise, it'll be used in healthcare, employment, education. It's incredibly dangerous. And so the transmilitary ban, it's more than just protecting trans people. It is protecting gender, so anyone that is discriminated against on the basis of gender, and then also an economic justice component. And so that's something that goes into the work that we do. It's often a multi-pronged approach, but we're looking at how this affects people that are the most marginalized. And that's an example of how we choose the work that we do.
Great. I want to talk about a couple of specific cases in a minute. I just want to let folks know that you are listening to Out in the Bay. My name is Eric Jansen. My guest is Imani Rupert Gordon, Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, based right here in San Francisco, but does work that has implications all across the country and, for that matter, across the world. And just a little side note here, I've talked to a lot of friends who like, oh, NCLR, I don't know. I never heard of them. What do they do? It's like, come on, they're right here. Have you found that to be the case, that you're not a household word like, I don't know, like GLAAD or the HRC, Human Rights Campaign? Is that a challenge?
Yeah, you know that. It is always a challenge when people in our community don't know why we do, when, you know, we're critical and, you know, we played a huge role in the fight for marriage equality, that the work that we do really lays the groundwork so that the recent Bostock decision that we saw can happen, that supports folks so that there are employment protections for everyone. So, you know, we are litigating high impact cases that really impact our community. So it's always unfortunate when people don't know the work that we do. It's our responsibility to make sure that people do. And so one of the things that I want to do is talk about the importance of our impact litigation, but also really support our public education work and our public policy work and our legislation work, because all of these things work together so that we're able to get to equality. You can see this in our Born Perfect campaign, and this is our campaign to end conversion therapy, and we want to do that in all 50 states, and we want to change hearts and minds. We want folks to be accepted by their parents, by their families, by their schools, by their churches. We want folks to understand that when we are talking about our communities, that these are that having the support is of the best things that can happen. This is moving fast. In maybe 8 years, we have 20 states that have passed protections to protect LGBTQ youth from conversion therapy. This is incredibly fast for this type of work. We've never seen this kind of movement in any sort of civil rights and any other sort of, like, with our LGBTQ equality. This is actually something that's moving really quickly and incredibly important.
Well, it's good to hear that there's some good news somewhere. There's also some bad news. The Trump administration over the summer already has taken some actions to roll back protections for transgender people, especially in the area of healthcare. I think there's a fairly new rule about allowing single-sex homeless shelters to exclude transgender people from facilities that correspond with their gender identity. That's one of the cases you're working on. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's something that's absolutely horrible. You know, we were really influential in working to make sure that, certainly with the ACA, that we're including trans folks to make sure that trans folks are protected. And so taking this out is actually just very cruel. The thing is, the ACA still protects based on sex, which does include sexual orientation and gender identity. So taking it out was just mean. So if anyone feels like they are being discriminated against, don't think that because of that rule that you're not protected. You absolutely are, and you should call us if you feel like that's the case. For this recent HUD rule, you know, again, just a cruel rule that will keep trans folks out of facility consistent with their gender identity. And that's something that also is just cruel, because we know that trans people are disproportionately impacted by homelessness, by being economically unstable, so more likely to use shelters. And this is making it unsafe for people, trans women of color especially. But if you go to our website, you can submit a comment. You can submit a comment until near the end of September. And these are really important because they have to read through all of these comments. So it's helpful just to submit a comment from a strategy perspective, just to have more comments. But then also, potentially, if the administration would read these and see an overwhelming majority is not interested in this, doesn't want this, that there might actually be a change there. And so let's do what we can to try to support people, because this is going to impact our community.
Great. And your website is nclrights.org. Let's Perfect. Make sure people hear that.
Thank okay. you so much. Yes, nclrights.org. Yeah.
So it seems like this is a perfect example of what you were talking about earlier, intersectionality. We have transgender people in homeless shelters because there's the economic justice piece of this puzzle here for sure, because we all know transgender women, I think, especially have a much, much, much higher unemployment rate than the general population and so many other categories within the U.S. population. Are there other things you want to talk about as far as racial and economic justice, other cases you're working on, especially with COVID-19 in the midst of this pandemic, ways that this pandemic is affecting LGBTQ people more so than others, or differently, perhaps I should say?
Sure. We know that during a pandemic that people from underrepresented groups are have been historically and negatively affected. You know, right now we know that Latinx communities are much more likely to test positive for COVID. And we know that Black folks are more likely to die from COVID and COVID-related illnesses. And so, you know, we suspect that with LGBTQ communities, that we will have negative health outcomes related to COVID. And so it's been a push of ours to make sure that we're collecting those numbers. That's something that's incredibly important. And so recently, California has determined that we will be collecting sexual orientation and gender identity data. But I would encourage folks to go out and advocate for their own states to collect this data as well. You know, it's really important. We know that in this country, that data informs policy and policy informs funding. And we can't do anything if we don't actually have the numbers. So whenever the administration, this one has done several times, has refused to count our numbers, to count the numbers of the folks in our community, that is going to have huge implications. You know, we know for a very long time with the HIV epidemic that they weren't looking at race. And that was something that was huge, because we know that HIV disproportionately impacts folks of color. And so, you know, looking at that means that we're better able to take care of our communities to know this. And so similarly for the LGBTQ community, it's really important that we know this. And so thinking about being intersectional, we know that people that are most likely to be incarcerated are LGBTQ people. And so we do some work with LGBTQ youth in detention centers and worked really closely with some community partners. And we were able to establish some guidelines that the governor reviewed and then pushed this out. We were able to take these guidelines and send them to every court in California. And since that's happened, there's been a 30% decrease in the number of youth that have been incarcerated. And we know that this is important because those are disproportionately people of color. They're disproportionately LGBTQ people. But also, it's not safe to have folks in there. And to have these young people taken out, we also know that once you've been part of systems, that these are things that will stay with you and that will, as you get older, continue to have interactions with systems. So hopefully this is also going to change the futures for some of these young people too. That's something that has been hugely helpful that we've been part of.
Fantastic. One last thing I want to ask you about before we have to say goodbye. Immigration. Restricting immigration has been high on the current administration's agenda. Many immigrants flee to the U.S. to flee persecution in their own countries, including on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. How has NCLR been fighting the Trump administration's immigration policies?
Sure. Folks actually come to this country seeking asylum because of their LGBTQ identities. Our asylum program, we've actually never lost a case of seeing over 300 people that have come that are looking for asylum, and we've been able to help folks get that, and we haven't lost a case. Now, the part that's really discouraging is that, you know, there was a recent rule that will actually make it virtually impossible for folks to escape their countries to come get asylum in the United States. And it's, you know, adding these things like this rule is like it would change the definition of persecution so that LGBTQ people would be less likely to get asylum here, have some different disqualifying factors in asylum. So, you know, people could be denied asylum if they traveled through more than two countries before reaching the United States. Really just these cruel things that will make it very, very difficult for people to reach asylum in this country, which is just, you know, something else. It's just cruel that this administration is doing. And again, it's going to disproportionately impact LGBTQ people.
Thank you. One last thing I want to ask you, and that's just, I think let's let people know how they can get involved if they have specific problems, and also looking forward to this November election. If there are battleground states, states that are close, anybody hearing this program, what states are on the list that they should call their relatives or friends and reach out to those particular states and say, hey, don't forget to vote because this one is a really important one. Or if people are having problems, perceiving problems with how they're going to vote in a state that may be having trouble with these mail-in ballots and there's doubts being cast on how they can vote.
So, you know, we are saying it is important for everyone to get out and vote. This is a strategy. It's not the only one, but it is a strategy to get your needs met. That's going to be important for absolutely everyone. We're a 501c3, so we're not saying to vote for anyone. We will say, you know, can say that, you know, this administration has been very hostile to our community. And so, you know, thinking about how to take care of yourselves and your families, people you care about, that a way that you can show that is with your vote. So pay attention to that. Like I said before, NCLR and other organizations will be following very, very closely about the ways that we can vote and keep and have our voice and have our voices heard and do that in the safest way possible. So we will be, as soon as we figure out what's happening here, we will be out here doing something. So you can listen to us, you can listen to whoever it is that you trust. And then lastly, if you think that you're being discriminated against on the basis of your sexual orientation or gender identity, anywhere in the country, you can go to nclrights.org. We have a hotline. We can help you find free and cheap lawyers in your own states that can help you work through your cases. So whatever's going on with you. So there are a lot of ways that we're seeing discrimination happen, but there's also there's a lot of help out there too. So you can visit us and we'll be happy to help you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to meet you. Imani Rupert Gordon has been my guest today, Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. She just took over in March. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
For more information about topics and resources mentioned in our conversation today, please see our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this program again, as well as past shows, and share them with friends and colleagues. While you're there, please sign up for our e-news and subscribe to our podcast. We're on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and more, outinthebay.org. And we will have links to the things we mentioned here, some of the comment pages on NCL Rights' website, which is nclrights.org. Today's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. Out in the Bay is brought to you in part by Comcast. Big thanks also to KSFP for bringing Out in the Bay back on the air. Please join us next week for a conversation with transgender opera singer Brianna Sinclair. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us out in the Bay.
Support for Out in the Bay comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to technology, volunteering time, providing financial support, and connecting people in need to high-speed internet at home. More at california.comcast.com.